Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Chorley. Who has been the best and indeed the worst Prime Minister Britain has ever had? We're going to try and answer that question in this week's episode. I'm joined by Times columnist Daniel Finkelstein, who's currently in the process of reading a biography of every Prime Minister ever. Andrew Jimson, the contributing editor of the Conservative Home website and author of a new book, Jimson's Prime Ministers, which chronicles the biographies of every Prime Minister Britain's had. And Katie Perrier, former Director of Communications in Theresa May's Downing Street, who's seen what a Prime Minister does up close. Before we begin, about a week ago, we ran a poll after Andrew wrote for Redbox, asking Redbox readers what they thought of who had been the best and worst Prime Minister of the past 40 years. Gordon Brown came out the worst on 36%, followed by David Cameron on 19% and Theresa May on 18%. And then on the best Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher came out top on 49%, Tony Blair on 31%, and poor old Theresa May just 2% on the best. But still time for it to tell
it.
She can build on that. So, Andrew, just talk us through. It's not a huge book, so how do you...
No, it's not meant to be huge. It's brief lives.
And so how have you managed to boil it down? How do you sort of approach something like that?
Well, with trepidation, but also a feeling of liberty, because you're not trying to say everything. And yeah. I found when I started working in political journalism that I knew very little political history. I didn't even know much about Disraeli and Gladstone. And then if you want to find out about them, you find that there's a wonderful book by Robert Blake, and it's 700 pages long. And also you don't get the context. And it's quite difficult to work out how Disraeli and Gladstone, these famous duels they had, how all that works. And so I wished there was a short book where you could get the whole sweep. And then, of course, you go and read about in much greater detail about whoever you're most interested in.
And so you wrote for Redbox on your favourite...
Yes.
Characters that you'd picked yes. out. Who was it? Remind me who it was who you concluded had been.
Well, I went for Disraeli that's in right. the end, but it's very difficult. I mean, Canning, I love. He was Prime Minister for only 119 days. An amazing man. Continually overplayed his hand and then died once he finally got there. One of the great foreign secretaries and certainly the greatest lighter of light verse ever to enter Downing Street, which is an amazing thing. I mean, he sent this thing in cipher to the ambassador who's in The Hague, who stayed up all night translating it and discovered it was a bit of light verse. He thought it was some very, very important message in this impenetrable code, almost impenetrable code, which was very difficult to work out. So he had a tremendous sort of impudent sense of humour, but also a fantastic understanding that public opinion was becoming very, very... It was becoming decisive and there was going to be a great battle between property and numbers and something like the Reform Bill. Some very liberal measure would be needed. He didn't live to do it.
And who did you conclude had been the worst?
Well, I think Lord Bute is certainly the most hated. He was hated by the mob and by the upper classes, and not only because he was Scotch. He was a very, very bad... He was a creepy royal favourite and didn't understand politics. Lord Rosebery was a failure, couldn't sleep, but won the Derby twice in the sort of 14 or so months that he was... Prime Minister. Poor Lord Aberdeen, a brilliant and expert diplomatist, but never been in the House of Commons, couldn't make himself clear, and allowed us to slide into the Crimean War because neither Turkey nor Russia understood what the British position was. And then, of course, the Crimean War was a most abominable series of catastrophes. So Aberdeen paid the price for that.
So, Danny, let's bring you in, because you're in the process. How many more books have you got left?
There's about five.
In your grey?
Yes, although five and a half, because I'm halfway through grey.
So who have you got left? Have you been keeping the big ones?
No, well, I've oddly enough, considering that I'm working with him on his memoirs, got Cameron to do, because I feel like, to complete the set, I have to do it. I've got Gordon Brown, Jim Callahan, Alec Douglas Hume, Aberdeen and Russell, and I'm halfway through Grey. But obviously, by now, I've covered the whole period, because obviously all these people overlap with each other. So
yeah.
If you read a biography of Palmerston, it'll overlap with Aberdeen's life, for example.
Yeah. And have you come to any conclusions about who you like and who you don't?
Well, one of the things that was my conclusion is that no Prime Minister gets it all right. So against every Prime Minister, you'll have something to say where they were, brilliant. You'll also have something to say which will make them look terrible in the light of history. So say very attractive figure like the 14th Earl of Derby, who had many times been on the right side of political issues from the Great Reform Bill through to creating a more mainstream Conservative Party, but was also totally wrong, for example, on the emancipation of Jews. You can argue whether he was on the right or wrong side of the Corn Laws. He was certainly on the wrong side of coercion in Ireland. So you have these attractive personalities who then get very, very big things wrong. You also get sort of real enigmas like the Prime Minister who succeeded Canning, who died after 4 months and who himself lasted only about 4 months, which was Frederick Robinson, the Viscount Goderich. And he was right about almost every major political issue, the emancipation of the slaves, political reform, the Corn Laws, free trade, and it was a totally useless Prime Minister. That was partly caused by the fact that he couldn't, as Andrew will say, couldn't keep his coalition together because the coalition had been formed for Canning, and he didn't have Canning's personality. But he was known as the blubberer because he used to cry when making speeches in the House of Commons, even when the issue was something like the trading rights over widgets.
Yeah, he burst into tears when he was stepping down, actually, and the king had to lend him his handkerchief and called him a great big blubbering blockhead. But those who can't stand the pressure, which in a funny way included Anthony Eden as well, people who are just somehow too thin-skinned. And it's a very paradoxical thing because you need to be very sensitive to public opinion but also incredibly tough.
One little extra thing. One of the things that has occurred to me is that Spencer Percival, who's remembered almost entirely really because he was assassinated in office and is the only person to have been assassinated in office, if he hadn't been, it occurs to me, he would have probably been Britain's longest serving Prime Minister and maybe quite a good one as well.
So just before I bring Katie in, is there, because she can tell us how... Because I'm slightly conscious that we're only really talking about people who have been Prime Minister quite a long time ago. Really, really dead.
Yes.
Are there any strands?
They're alive to us, Matt.
Of course. And they live in your book.
Yeah.
Leap for the page. But how are there any sort of strands of what it is or isn't that makes a good or bad Prime Minister?
Yes. I think the ability to stand up in the House of Commons and say intelligible things. Not necessarily very
eloquent. Because that's sort of timeless, isn't it? People say, times change.
No, Walpole was very good. He made people feel they understood the finances, even when, as Lord Chesterfield said, they almost certainly didn't. But he made it all so clear, and that is absolutely vital. And that's why I think we've had a very, very low incidence of either of complete idiots or of criminals. Because when you stand up in the House of Commons, you reveal whether you have a clear and reputable outlook on things or not.
And to keep a coalition together, that's absolutely vital. Yes. So someone like Shelburne, who was brilliant intellectually, but he didn't last very long because he was thin-skinned and people didn't like him.
So, Katie, looking back on all that history, how do our current crop of politics, because although you work for Theresa May, you've worked in politics for a long time, you saw David Cameron up close as well. How do our current crop of politicians compare?
Honestly, it's too early to say in many regards because in history we can only prove in 50 years' time or 100 years' time, for example, that the referendum was a great idea because, our economy outstripped the rest of Europe. We only know that in 50 years' time. So we can't really compare the two right now. What I think we can compare is the qualities that are needed in a good Prime Minister, as you say.
Yes.
And one of them is decision-making, an ability to make decisions and follow through with those decisions. And so some recent Prime Ministers may have made the wrong decisions, and we could say Blair in Iraq, but the ability to make a decision and lead your government through that decision.
Yeah, it's not only ability to make decisions, but to carry your cabinet with you. And in fact, the greatest leaders... I mean, I thought that this business of cabinet government was just a nice constitutional theory, but it is actually the best way. I'm now convinced it's the best way to run things, because one individual, however gifted, cannot understand the money, the defence, the foreign policy, every aspect. You have to have meetings where people can actually say, well, great leaders like George Washington in America did this, and actually Churchill. Of course, there's a great focus on him as an individual, but he ran a great coalition, and he had all these Labour people and gifted people who hadn't been involved in politics. That is one of the things about a great leader, I think, is bringing in lots of gifted people, actually also, from very different sort of origins and very different outlooks.
And it's the ability also, I think, and those qualities need to change in time. So you would not have needed to be a great TV performer back in the day, but now it's pretty much a prerequisite in terms of what's valued as a good Prime Minister.
Although interesting, what Andrew was saying about being good in the House of Commons actually is a good test of people rising up.
One theory that that reading all this work has pierced is that we've got terrible politicians now, and it's not the golden age anymore. I think almost exactly the opposite is the case. It seems to me as though, as time has gone on, the country's got richer, healthier, wiser, better, and so have the politicians. That doesn't mean to say that there's not a lot of variation around the mean, but the education levels, the experience of outside life, the ability to communicate to the public. Some people never visited their constituents and wouldn't know how to talk to anyone outside a small world, the understanding of the world. These are not because the people necessarily are better, but because we require more of the person holding that office. And so I think actually there's quite a good case that some of the great prime ministers, Attlee, Thatcher, possibly McMillan, you might include in that category, Churchill, have actually really been quite recent.
The intellectual calibre of prime ministers in the 19th century, I would have thought, was on average higher than in the 20th.
But it's not the only...
Yes, that's not the only test. What I'm really interested in too is what role does luck have to play in the success of your tenure as prime minister in terms of what you inherited from the previous incumbent?
Yeah.
And, you know, whether or not you inherited a good economy, whether or not, you know, you had a disruptive cabinet that you argued all the time. I mean, how successive could Blair and Brown could have been if they didn't have that disruptive relationship at the heart of their government, for example?
Yes. But also inherited a booming economy.
Indeed.
You know, the sun didn't just start shining in May 97.
So what role does luck have to play in terms of what the hand you're dealt with?
Well, I think luck is absolutely... The cards do have to fall well for you at some point. But, of course, the longer you stay in the game... I mean, Disraeli is a classic example. He had so many disadvantages. He'd been born into the Jewish faith, only baptised into the Church of England when he was 12 because his father fell out with the synagogue. He then, at a very early age, contracted enormous debts which stayed with him throughout his life. He wrote disreputable novels, including novels which mocked the people. He set up a newspaper called The Representative, which was going to rival The Times, and it was a total flop. And then he wrote a novel at the age of only 22 in which he mocked the people who had lost a lot of money in this venture. And also he puffed South American mining shares, which were essentially fraudulent. And he looked ridiculous. He dressed in an absurd dandified figure. It took 5 attempts to get into Parliament, and then his maiden speech was a flop. You would not have expected that he was going to win through and become one of the great prime ministers and the only prime minister to whom a reigning sovereign has erected a memorial after his death, Queen Victoria, who, of course, loved Disraeli and couldn't stand Gladstone.
So you don't have to deal with, as a modern prime minister, though you do have to deal with the people that you did all the time in the past was the monarch. Yes. And, of course, you know, the only reason we think of Walpole as being the first prime minister really is because when George the First died in 1727, everyone thought that Walpole would fall, and he managed, because of his majority in the Commons, really, although also because the Queen wanted him to survive when George II became Prime Minister. So you... handling the monarch was absolutely critical to why, you know, for example, Pitt goes out and in and out of office. Yes. Both Pitt the Elder and Pitt the Younger. Why Fox never became Prime Minister. This is obviously, you know, a big factor in history of Prime Ministers. Now you have to deal with a different audience, which is public opinion, which you didn't have to, you couldn't ignore entirely. That's more interesting. But it was a different public, and
they jolly well tried to ignore it. They tried to keep reporters out of the House of Commons throughout the 18th century. And Dr. Johnson famously had to make the stuff up. He'd just be told that Perrier spoke on one side and Chorley spoke on the other side and would then make the speeches
up.
It
makes history writing quite difficult because they're always guessing what someone said in the House from reports that are not necessarily direct.
We've lost the speeches of Pitt the Elder by reputation, the greatest Commons orator ever, volcanic. He could really bury you. And he spoke spontaneously as well. So he's absolutely devastating. He responded immediately to what you said. But we only have fragments of these. We have the impression they made on people. We don't have the actual speech.
Well, I remember reading from when I was chairman of the press gallery last year and read up some of the history on it. And there were the reports at the time, there were concerns about allowing reporters in,
yes,
because it might lead to showboating and
yeah,
people giving absolutely overly exciting speeches, which, having sat, yes, in the press gallery more recently, I don't think that was a concern we needed to avoid about too much.
Yeah.
It's sort of weird in a way that the, yes, fact they are now televised and reported on constantly, yes, actually the quality of speeches in the Commons is not particularly high these days. Katie, do you think that the modern politicians, to try and judge them against somebody in the 19th century, is just sort of unfair?
Yeah, very much so. And I think that people have very short memories as well. So your Redbox poll, which came forward saying that, you know, I think it was Theresa May and David Cameron didn't come out too well.
So on the best Prime Minister, Cameron got 5%, May got 2%. Because of the way we do the polls, we can only have 7. So I went back 40 years. It also had the advantage.
Spencer Compton, Earl of Wilmington, Matt.
Complete outlier.
I think that people have short memories about what is achieved in office, and also a lack of respect about what it entails and what a difficult job it is. Yeah. We are very dismissive and have apathy towards our politicians generally in these days. I'd like to know from Andrew and Danny in terms of respect for politicians throughout the years and whether or not that's kind of plummeted, or is it always been at that level?
Well, it's interesting. When Percival was shot, his wife Jane was in Great George Street, which people who know Westminster will know is just around the corner from the house, and she was told that he'd been killed, and she heard then the crowds cheering in Parliament Square, and they then tried to overturn the carriage in which Bellingham was being taken from being charged, which he was immediately, to jail, because there was such an anti-monarch and anti-. Politician feel. And so there are quite often stories. Goderich had an incident after he introduced a protectionist legislation in which his servant shot a demonstrator who was trying to invade their house. Pitt was assailed on the way to his club. So violent altercation with members of the public is quite a frequent theme.
Pelham defended Walpole with his sword and said, who'll be the first? It's quite...
So it's improved dramatically.
We had the Brighton bomb quite recently. Thatcher could easily have perished in that.
And of course, because it happened in the Houses of Parliament.
Just right. Yes. You can still see it if you go into the House of Commons through the St. Stephen's entrance. You can't go through St. Stephen's entrance, but through the St. Stephen's courtyard or sort of corridor, as it were. That was where the old house was. On the left-hand side, as you go up, you'll see a plaque in the place just outside the lobby of what was then the House of Commons before the fire in 1834, where Percival was assassinated.
And he was shot by an ancestor of Henry Bellingham, who was...
the Norfolk MP at the moment.
Yeah, and former minister.
Another reason why it's hard, I think, to judge those currently that we know about in terms of history is because I think over time biographers have different slants on different people, and so they've influenced our view of them as we go on in time. And so we may well find that in 100 years' time from the position we are in now, we could have wonderful biographies of some politicians that at the moment are pretty much, hated.
That's true, and often we can only remember one thing, with Eden, obviously, is Suez. Blair, it's Iraq. Blair had a very, very protracted honeymoon, and perhaps that will come through in some of the history writing. I think the problem at the moment is that he's so self-righteous.
I think Blair will look better in historical terms, both in terms of achievement, the stability when he was Prime Minister, his ability to keep the sheer size of his election majorities. Just on this question of books, I'll plug Andrew's book rather than letting him do it himself. It's really valuable because when I got to the second Prime Minister after reading Walpole, Spencer Compton, Earl of Wilmington, there isn't a biography of him at all. You have to use the Dictionary of National Biography, and a man called Carteret was actually in fact running the government. That's why nobody's bothered to do a biography of Wilmington. But there are others, the fourth Duke of Devonshire, who was Prime Minister for a year, there's no biography of him. And then sometimes there's where there's otherwise was famine, there's feasts. So with Derby, you have to read 2 800 page books for somebody who was Prime Minister totally in total for about four years, over three spread over. He never had a long government. This is a very valuable effort because it means that all in one place you can read something about everybody.
In a sec, we'll talk about. I particularly want to talk about Winston Churchill and whether or not his position as all conquering best PM ever should be challenged. We'll be back after this.
Hold up. Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Red Box podcast with me, Matt Jolly. I'm joined by Daniel Finkelstein, Katie Perrier and Andrew Jimson. We're talking about the best and worst prime ministers ever. Let's just start then with Churchill.
Yeah.
On all polls, he comes out as sort of the best prime minister ever.
Macmillan told him in 1954, and made a note of this in his diary, and Macmillan got on very well with Churchill. He said, "It took Hitler to make you prime minister and me an undersecretary. The Tory party would do neither." The Tory party mistrusted Churchill, who had, of course, ratted from the Tory party and then rejoined, but wasn't really in sympathy with these businessmen who ran the party between the wars. And of course, had been a tremendous critic on and got things wrong on the abdication and on India. And as far as public opinion was concerned, he got it wrong on appeasement as well. And he drank a lot, and he was a sort of strange maverick figure.
In fact, it struck me watching Darkest Hour, which has obviously won lots of awards the past month or so, there was more of the sort of downside of Churchill in the criticism of him than you quite often get in portrayals of him, showing that he wasn't universally popular and the mistakes he'd made in the past and that sort of thing. You're shaking your head though.
I thought that film was terrible. I know everyone thought it was great. I thought Darkest Hour was one of the five worst films I've ever seen, actually.
Golly.
I thought, well, it was just packed with cliches. Anyway, I do think the downside of Churchill is very interesting, and what it demonstrates is the role that probability plays in prime ministers. So Churchill basically made a decision that, despite the fact that the chances of us defeating Germany in May 1940 were very small, the costs of surrendering to them were very large, and when you multiply the two together, it was worthwhile carrying on with the war. And this turned out to be correct probabilistic.
I think this is a completely nonsensical account. But Churchill revelled in conflict. He'd been in five wars by the age of 22.
But as I say, if you take a wider view of Churchill's career, you can see that he constantly took extremely long shot bets on positions that then didn't work out for him. Then he was lucky because the one that did come off was where
the cost
was the big one.
Now,
then if you look at, say, for example, Blair, many of the decisions we've taken, which is the iterations of the rule we're going to face up to dictators, turned out to be successful. And he indeed won his reputation partly because he took that view on Sierra Leone and Kosovo and was successful in it. But then, of course, with Iraq, it was not successful. Cameron is the same. We'd remember him entirely differently if having made a big bet on Scotland, which came off, and a big bet on the AV referendum, which came off, his bet on the European referendum did not come off. So a lot of the time we're remembering people as a result of probabilistic calculations they made that they got on the wrong end of. And that's not necessarily a reflection on their personal characteristics. Situation and luck plays a lot. I said about Goderich earlier. Yep. You know, was it because Goderich was a blubberer? Possibly. Or was it because by that point the coalition between Liberal Conservatives and Whigs had become baroque and he couldn't sustain it?
Yeah. Contrasting that with politicians who maybe don't make big calls, don't gamble big. I'm looking at you, Katie, partly because there's sometimes a criticism of Theresa May. She takes a very long time over things and doesn't have that sort of instinct. But then, of course, she did gamble big with the election and that didn't pan out quite how she planned. But presumably the whole time a prime minister is sitting in number 10, having to make decisions which don't often seem that big at the time but could end up having big repercussions later, and then along comes something like her poisoning in Salisbury and your entire government is consumed by it. So although a decision to go to war is big, quite a lot of the time you're making decisions you don't realise quite which way they're going to go.
and you're obviously making decisions that are only going to know in a few years' time how well they pan out. I remember things like Hinkley Point, where Theresa May kind of froze the decision-making process and wanted to just consider it a little bit further. But then on other issues like Heathrow, David Cameron pushed that into the long grass, and Theresa May was absolutely adamant that as part of a post-Brexit Britain, we would have airport expansion in the UK. So I think that we forget about some of the decisions that are made, and we just focus on the ones that aren't made in the long term. I'm very interested to kind of know about the individual personalities of prime ministers and whether or not that plays into the successful knowledge that we think that they've been a good prime minister in the long run. Churchill, known as being, had a really good war, but he was quite pedantic and he rubbed people up the wrong way. And I see him as someone that was quite selfish at times, especially in the way that he held on too long and didn't have that kind of succession plan. And he was quite ill by the end, and then Eden kind of was quite ill. And
well, he had a succession plan, but he didn't keep to it.
He didn't keep to it.
I think he had told Eden that, of course, Eden was named as his successor in 1942 because obviously if Churchill's plane crashed or something, then a successor would be needed. But I think he did tell Eden that he would give up at the end of the war and not make the mistake that Lloyd George had made of carrying on after the war. Well, of course, Churchill had decided he had no intention of giving up.
I think personalities play a big role. For example, David Cameron managed to keep people in his in their posts for 3 or 4 years, a very stable government through a very difficult time. And Blair went through kind of several home secretaries. There was one every couple of months at one point, I think. I think that your personality, whether you're suited to the job, and you don't know that until you're in it. But other people from afar could say, well, Theresa May was never suited to be Prime Minister. Well,
I think it's
quite actually
true.
About
That's
being
absolutely
in the job.
Right. And I think a lot of people, particularly the press, tended to underestimate and misunderstand Cameron and were completely astonished when he won the election in 2015. And were also pretty astonished that the coalition had held together for 5 years from 2010. Those were really big professional achievements, but they didn't see his professionalism and how he'd actually learned how to do politics in the Conservative Research Fund, because they were so, there's a kind of journalist like myself who's been to a not very glamorous fee-paying school and has had a not very glamorous life at university and has certainly never been elected to something as grand as the Bullingdon Club, who is absolutely obsessed by class. And so the press, lots of people in the press were obsessed by Cameron's class, didn't actually realise he was a professional politician. He wasn't just some sort of languid chap who wandered in from an Evelyn Waugh novel or something.
But also, because there was a big part of the Tory party which disagreed with what he was doing, they couldn't see, they were blinded to the fact that what he was doing it quite well.
Yes, and he was being very Anglican and saying, let's have a middle course, which in the end, of course, you can't on Europe, but it worked for a bit.
Danny, you mentioned at the beginning you're working with David Cameron on his memoirs. How much, this probably applies to all prime ministers, because most prime ministers end up writing the memoirs at some point, sort of put their side of the story. What's that process like to try and rewrite history, maybe?
I suppose that the job is to do two things, which is to record the events that happened in your life, which only you can know because you know some of the inside things that happened, the discussions you had with people, but it's also to put to understand what the case is. So in David Cameron's book, of course, he's going to have to explain and defend the decisions he took on Europe. But he also got to advance the case for the liberal conservatism that he supported. But he also has to tell his story. So that all those things. But naturally, quite a lot of prime ministers didn't write memoirs. I mean, it's a relatively modern phenomenon, isn't it? Andrew will know this better than me, but quite a lot of them died apart from anything else. I mean, one of the things that we don't have now is this constant recurrence of the ill health, the Duke of Portland virtually dying in office, Liverpool virtually dying in office, Pelham, Pitt actually dying in office, Canning actually dying in office. I mean, this happened quite a lot.
But they stayed in office for so much longer then. I mean, now away from...
They were older. Now we've got this problem of
some of them
former prime ministers hanging about and giving speeches all the time.
I haven't done a statistical analysis. I don't think that'll turn out to be true.
Okay.
First of all, I think there were quite a lot of prime ministers, annoyingly from the point of view of my project and probably from the point of view of your book, Andrew, who last 4 months or a year, and therefore you have to spend just as long on those people reading about them. Certainly not for you, maybe, Andrew, but for the way that I'm doing it.
When is Cameron's book out, by the way?
I don't know, actually, when he's going to
get a move on.
So on David Cameron, the question, because he will be remembered because of the EU referendum, And there were the people who maybe might have agreed with him on lots of things that he did to the Tory party, but now hate him because they back Remain and they think that he's ruined the country. But he's also not, doesn't seem to be getting any credit from Leavers either for helping bring about the thing
they
wanted.
Well, it's so early, isn't it? We don't know how Brexit is going to turn out. But he kept the Tory party together, which is really absolutely fundamental.
But in a way,
all Tory leaders since Robert Peel failed to do that have known that that is really their duty, and they must adapt other things in order to...
But in a way, it doesn't matter how Brexit turns out, because if Brexit's a disaster, he'll be blamed for it. Yeah. And if it's a good idea,
I'm robust on this. I robustly supported the idea of holding a referendum because it was right to ask people. And one of the reasons we know it was right to have a referendum is because when people voted in it, they overturned what the political elite thought, including me, by the way. And that suggested that, in fact, when you asked broad opinion on this incredibly important topic, you got a different answer. And I also think that I personally found his liberal conservatism very attractive. I think the Conservative Party, if it wants to be the big political force in the future, is going to have to understand the lessons of the Enlightenment that Steven Pinker puts in his recent book. And David Cameron did see that, was leading the Conservative Party in the right direction, held a referendum I thought was a sensible hold, and then had to resign when he lost it. When somebody asks me, will he be well judged by history? Well, unfortunately, he's going to be judged by historians, almost all of whom will regard Remain as the right answer.
When you reflect about positions of probability, the fact is that David Cameron made that judgment because he may not have won the 2015 election without it. And therefore, there's this role whereby what are the decisions the Prime Ministers have made over the course of history that were only because of the alternative or because they've pretty much felt that they were forced to do that. Otherwise would have been out of office anyway. So, and I think that the in the future we will look back on David Cameron as indeed holding not only a good coalition together, but the Conservative Party together. Yeah. And maybe we will also look back on Theresa May in that way too.
So if you were hypothetically still in number 10, Katie, advising Theresa May, how does she get better judged in the Red Box podcast in 100 years' time when people are looking back on the best Prime Minister? What does she need to do to not just be remembered for calling a absolutely disastrous election?
That would be assuming that she really cares about you and your red box, Matt. For a start.
She appeared to be a fan when she made jokes about it the other night.
No, I think it's about the fact that you don't want to be just known for your election campaign. You want to be known for the fact that you held the country and the party together through one of the most difficult times in its history. She's in a unique position. Nobody else has had to exit the European Union in the way that we are about to do within the next 12 months. And we'll give her credit for that, but also making some real developments on the domestic front, because I don't think you can ignore that and be obsessed by Brexit. She says she's going to be the saviour of the housing crisis, and I think that's fundamentally important if you want Conservative people to vote Conservative for you in the future.
And just along the panel, do you think that she'll fight another election?
No.
And very quickly, because I'm conscious we're running out of time, is there anything from looking back over history that gives us any guide to the sort of people who will become Prime Ministers in the future? Are there any people on the way up who you think fit the bill based on what we've been talking about?
I think people are rather fed up with the careerist politician who rises because they sort of suck up to the hierarchy. And actually that's one reason why Corbyn is in some ways popular, because palpably he did not spend his last 40 years sucking up to the hierarchy, but he's speaking his mind. And I think people are quite keen on people, for example, people like Rory Stewart or Tom Tugendhat, who have sort of pro-consular or military experience, or Dan Jarvis on the Labour side. I think people are much more inclined to, or Johnny Mercer, people are much more inclined to vote for people like that than for someone who they think is a sort of dreary percentage player.
I mean, Jeremy, one of the things that this study of Prime Ministers has suggested is just how out of the run Jeremy Corbyn is and how extraordinary that is.
Yes.
And we also to sort of enjoy, as political observers, such a moment.
Yes.
He's the post-war consensus that Attlee forged behind a sort of popular front of democratic countries rather than a popular front of socialists, which is what was being urged on him by Cripps and others.
Yeah.
That has stuck with the Labour Party and obviously been the Tory party's position broadly as well. And Jeremy Corbyn breaks with that position. So what we're seeing, for example, now about Russia, that is a position almost nobody in the whole run of prime ministers would have taken. With the possible exception, I wonder, of Walpole.
Walpole wanted peace. Certainly, you want to keep out of this sort of stuff. And he boasted that 40,000 people had been killed that year in Europe and not one Englishman.
Mind you, you know, they always used to say of Walpole that he was a crook and he used to deny it. If you ever go and visit, which I do advise, his house in Norfolk, it is
gorgeous.
Absolutely the end of that argument.
Lord
he
Chumley.
Definitely was a crook.
Lord Chumley. No, not a crook.
Brilliant.
No, no.
It was extraordinary. How on earth did he earn that money?
That wasn't, it was not crooked. And he ended
so
up
in
with,
that way, Corbyn
he had very heavy debts. Thanks to his life of public service. All these bloody writers and people were there against him, that's true.
And Katie, who have you got your eye on as the potential next... I mean, obviously, we've talked before about your many years working with Boris Johnson.
Oh, yeah.
Does he still fit the bill?
I mean, you couldn't pick anybody right now. I think it's going to be like a 20-horse race when it comes down to it. But I think Andrew's right in terms of the fact that people now want that authentic approach to a life before politics. They can touch the real world and understand what people are going through. So that applies to not just the armed forces, which I think are well represented in the House of Commons. It applies to those that maybe worked in the healthcare profession before, nurses, doctors. We have several of those in both sides of the House, and I think that they're very well respected as well. And as we go through very difficult times in terms of tackling our problem with adult social care, we may be calling upon people like that to come up with some of the solutions.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Do get in touch and let us know what you think. Email redbox@thetimes.co.uk or tweet us at timesredbox. Tell us you've been listening to the podcast and who you think has been the best and worst prime ministers that we've had. For now, that's all we've got time for. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes on your Android device and sign up to my morning email briefing at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. But for now, from Katie Perrier, Andrew Jimson, Daniel Finkelstein and me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no. So yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.